Hey team, welcome back to another episode of the Student Paramedic Podcast.
My name is Brayden, and I'm joined here today with Alex.
Hey guys.
And today we have a very special guest, Dr. Andrew Tagg. So if you could just introduce yourself, that'd be awesome.
So I qualified a long, long time ago in NHS that I decided not to be a part of. I left the NHS around about mid-2000s, and I thought I would retrain as an anaesthetist. And so I decided to join Princess Cruises, and I worked as a cruise ship doctor for 4.5 years, sailing around the world before eventually deciding that there's no way I was going to go back to England because it was too cold, wet and miserable. And my wife and I settled in Melbourne. And when we landed here, I got back on the emergency medicine training program. And as part of my pediatric placement, I founded with some friends a website, Don't Forget the Bubbles, essentially as a means to store revision notes. And that seems to have taken over most of my non-work life at the moment. So the website itself gets about 1.5 million page views a year. We've run international conferences. We've had all our COVID data has been quoted by the World Health Organization. And we are trying to really make it a lot easier for the everyday person who may potentially look after children to deal with any situation they come across. So whether that's nursing staff, advanced care practitioners, or pre-hospital providers. And because we know that looking after kids can be incredibly scary if you haven't seen them on a regular basis. And so much of what we do is teaching people what's normal and what's abnormal. And it's great if you've got your own kids to practice on. But, you know, one of the challenges we've found with COVID is that you can't go into your local emergency department and see kids in the same way that you used to be able to. And so we're going to try and provide some of that knowledge from us and on the website and on our YouTube channel so you can learn a little bit more about kids.
Absolutely. And you hit the nail on the head then before when you said a lot of people feel a bit daunted. Well, it's daunting to, approach a pediatric child, particularly in the pre-hospital environment. That's something that a lot of students that we talk to say, and a lot of paramedics as well, do find working with or going to a case with a pediatric quite overwhelming. How do you, overcome that overwhelm?
So it is challenging. And I think we recognize in hospital that we are in a really lucky environment. We're essentially dry, warm, we've got decent light. We don't have dogs and neighbors yapping at our heels. And so when I've done some of the pre-hospital work, I think it's recognizing that whatever you do is going to make the situation better, not worse. You've been called to help. And the most important thing you can do is go in with a sense of calm. And you may not feel calm on the surface, but at least having a little bit of background knowledge so you've got a sense of what might be going on, the questions you want to ask, taking a nice slow deep breath and thinking, okay, the worst thing that's going to happen, okay, yeah, I'm going to have to do CPR on this child, which is not a nice thing at all, but it's still better than what is happening at this moment in time when I'm not there. So when you know you're going for a signal one and it's a difficulty in breathing, for instance, in a toddler, I would be running through my head, what are the most likely things that could be going on? And realistically in kids, there's only about 5 diseases you really need to know about, things like bronchiolitis, croup and asthma, or asthma, bronchiolitis and croup, the ABC of breathing problems. That will cover about 70% of all your calls. And then as long as you know a little bit about pediatric analgesia, that will cover pretty much everything else in between. And there's always going to be these horrible rare cases of sepsis or head injuries or motor vehicle accidents or non-accidental injury. But really, having a core knowledge of some of those sort of basic conditions, as well as how to approach that sort of child and how to take, because obviously kids can't tell you what's going on. So it's kind of like veterinary medicine. So, you know, it's how you're going to approach the child and the environment and the parents all as a one-er. Rather than, okay, I'm going to go in, I'm going to look at this adult and ask them some appropriate questions, and I'm absolutely going to know what's going on. You're not going to know that with kids. But you do have that huge advantage in that generally most of them don't have a lifetime history of hypertension, diabetes, and cardiovascular disease and long lists of medications that you can't remember the names of. So there are, you know, a lot less questions you need to be able to ask in sort of situations.
Definitely. You summed that up really well. I remember going to a CPD event with a pediatrician who works up at the Queensland Children's Hospital, and basically said that with children, it's all monkey see, monkey do. So they see their parents and their parents are all stressed out. So then the child then becomes more stressed out because that's their emotional connection. How can you try and like work towards making you the emotional connection and that sense of calm and resonating that to the child?
That's a really good way of putting it. I think, you know, calm is contagious in these situations. And so it's going there with that sense of essentially a sense of authority, a fake it till you make it point of view. So you go in, you take your kid in, you have a standardized approach to what you're going to do in your basic assessment, because that way you're not fumbling and thinking of what to do. So I would go in and introduce myself to the patient, no matter how old they are, even if they're 3 weeks old and they're not going to talk to you, and then identify who is in the room with you and who your caller is or who your parent or carer is, and say, "Hi, my name is Andrew. We're here to help," because that's what they've called for. Essentially, they need to know what's going on. And hopefully, and sometimes you might need a little bit of a reassuring pat on the shoulder. You need to get down to that child's level to show that, you know, you're not a big burly beast to be feared, but you're actually somewhere there to help. Because often these kids are maybe on the bed or on the floor. Just by getting down to that child's height, you're putting yourself in this sort of position of vulnerability. And this is how it looks to the parents who are standing up potentially, or the dad who's angry because you've taken a whole extra minute longer than you thought. But you put yourself in this submissive position. But most importantly, all that time you're looking and focusing on the child. And most parents can feel that that child is the most important thing in the room to you as the paramedic, as well as to them. And that really helps calm them down. And so rather than then trying to shout to get yourself heard, it's important to use silence and let the parents or carers tell their story and then ask your clarifying questions afterwards. But even while they're doing this, you're making your moves visually, you're looking at the patient and you're starting your sort of simple pediatric assessment triangle on this kid. So just whilst you've got information going in this way, you're also getting information in through your eyes at the same time.
Absolutely. And that makes a lot of sense. So even one of the best pieces of advice that I got when I was on my pediatric nursing placement was the parents and the family know the best about the child. They know everything about the child. So really ensuring that you listen to the family is really important, rather than just brushing them off to do your assessment.
Yeah, absolutely, Alex. You've got to validate their concerns, because it may be that you go to this house and think, oh God, there's absolutely nothing wrong with this kid. They look perfectly well to you. But for the parent, this child is pretty much the most important thing they own. Owns the wrong word. They have in their lives. And I think by just brushing off their concerns, it makes them feel worthless. You got to sort of validate their concern, say, I understand why you would be concerned that it looked like, you know, Johnny wasn't breathing or looked like he was having a seizure. Tell me exactly what did you see? You know, and that way you can get them to describe in their own words what they saw, rather than using words that they think you want to hear. So often patients, whether they're adults or children, will use words that they think you want to hear. So they'll say, I think I saw my son have a fit. Well, a fit could be many, many different things. Or I saw my son have a seizure. I want to know exactly in their words what they saw happen before the event, during the event, and then afterwards. So it may be that really what this was he had a vasovagal for whatever reason, been running around, doing something, looked like pale and ghostly pale, started complaining of pins and needles and tingling in his fingers, and then collapsed to the ground. Okay, that sounds like a simple vasovagal. But if you then keep that child standing up because they're feeling weak and wobbly and try and get them to walk from, you know, the outside playground into school, then they can have they've already tried to dump their blood pressure, and the normal physiological response to dropping your blood pressure is essentially to get your head lower than your heart. And so, you know, that's why we faint. But you've not been able to do that. So the next thing that happens is you have an anoxic seizure. And that's a completely normal thing. But without getting the preceding history from the parent, you might think, oh my goodness, this child's had a seizure. Let's get some benzos out and do something. Or it may be that this child's rigoring because they're febrile. And without getting a good history, mum or dad may say, okay, he's had a snotty, runny nose. He's sounding crappy. He's had a fever for the last couple of days and he had a seizure. And there's a big difference between a child that is shaking uncontrollably because they've got a temperature of 39.5 and a child that's having a febrile convulsion and then what they're doing. And so getting that clarity around what the parents mean is really important. And so there's lots of little things in that history. So, parents may say, my child's been vomiting. I want to know how much they vomited. I want to know what it looks like. I want to know because, kids vomit for pretty much any reason at all. You scare a child and they throw up. Or put one of my kids in the back of a car for more than 20 minutes, they throw up. But there's lots of different medical reasons that children throw up. And so I want to know more detail about it, what it's like. And you'll be amazed what parents do. I've had parents bring in photos of their kids vomit into the emergency department for me to look out of. I had them bring it in bags. I've had one parent bring in their kids' dirty nappy saying, look, there's blood in it, and asking me to put on some gloves and dig through this dirty nappy to find the blood. It wasn't blood, it was just a tomato skin, but that's enough to freak them out and get them to call an ambulance. And so it's really important, absolutely validate their concerns, but make sure you know what you're asking about first in that sort of history.
That's really good on how to try and separate that emotion from the parents to then move forward and make the parents calm, make the baby calm, as well as get the appropriate stuff that you need from them. The next question kind of leads on still with the emotion factor. How can you try and separate, okay, this is the job I'm trying to do, to these are emotions and I don't feel comfortable doing this?
I think that's really, really hard space to be in, Braden. I think lots of people who do medicine and whatever sort of role they have are very good at compartmentalizing at the time. So you see someone, a child that's been abused, for instance, you go into their home and pick them up because they've got a broken arm, but there's something else going on. The house looks filthy. There's a couple of horrible, scary dogs in the yard. Stepdad looks a bit dodgy. And you can start to feel angry in yourself, sorry for the kid at the same time. But you're putting in a little box, and you put in that little box to deal with later, because what you've got to do is focus on the patient in front of you. And that's where your prior practice is really important. So whether you're on station and you're branching, there's nothing much going on, running through some of these simple scenarios. What would I do if, your brains are sort of the best virtual simulator we've got. So rather than thinking about mannequins, what would I do if I went into a job and there's a child that's had an arrest in front of me? I'm going to freak out. That's fine. But just by thinking through the mechanical processes of just the sheer physical acts of what you do, it helps you to sort of pack away some of those emotions for later. But it's really important then that you take the time to be able to unpack those in a supportive way. I get stressed out when I deal with pediatric resusses, but part of my role as the team leader is to remain calm for everyone else in that situation. And no matter how I feel inside, I could feel really awful, and often I do. You just feel for the parents, you feel the suffering that's gone on in that room. You have to hold it together for the parents, the neighbors who are going to see you, the paramedics, the nursing team, that sort of thing, because you need to get on and do your job. But that doesn't mean you can't sit down afterwards and think and talk to a friend, your crewy, someone in the hospital, someone at Brian, say, actually, I've just had the worst job ever, and talk about it. And I think we're really bad at talking about these emotional experiences we have at work. We have all these sort of morbidity and mortality meetings and, get told off when you made a bad decision, but we don't really have that opportunity to unpack some of the emotions behind what we do. And I think being able to share, we've all been in similar scenarios, but just by hiding them away, it makes them a lot harder to deal with. And I know from talking it's the sort of thing you can only really share with people who will understand. You know, your partner may be non-medical, and I think it's really hard then to be able to go home and say, I've had a really bad day at work. I've had to resuscitate a two-year-old boy and they have died. They will have a degree of empathy and sympathy, but they won't really understand of what it was like to be in the room at the time. And it is a shit thing to do. And it's a really horrible space to be. And I think that's why some of these communities of practice that we build up together, whether that's through people like you guys, through our Facebook groups, through our friends, I think it's really important to be able to talk about these things. And then, for instance, let's say you do a job and you think, okay, I wish I could have done, maybe I could have done better. That thought is going to whir around in your head for a very long time. And only by talking to someone can you help unpack it. And then whether that's doing something through the employee assistance program, talking to your CSO, or what I'm really a big fan of is when we get our paramedics come in and we've had a bad job or a good job, no matter, and they come and come to me afterwards and ask for, okay, give me a bit more information. How did I do? What could I do differently next time? And often the answer is nothing, but I'm there to be that support person who is somewhat slightly less emotionally invested in how things have gone. You know, it must be really bad, awful for you guys. You know, you get to see these patients and then you're involved in their worst half hour of their lives ever. And then you just give them over to complete strangers and you have no idea what happens to them ever again. And so trying to find a way of getting some sort of feedback or follow-up system can really help take away some of that emotional burden that you get. Because you don't know what's happened. There's this sort of what if thing going on in your head, or I wonder what's happened to X. And you need a bit of emotional closure sometimes. And so one way I think of getting that is to go to your, you know, you've dropped them off, go in later on that day, talk to one of the doctors involved, and most of us be very, very happy to talk to you guys about what's been going on and say, you've done everything possible. It's okay. And so, you know, that's one thing you can do that's going to help relieve some of those emotions. I think the things that, I mean, I've been very bad at compartmentalizing things over my life. And I know I still remember a lot of patients that I've dealt with that have died from when I was a junior trainee. And you think about them now and you think it's still okay to have a cry about them. That means you're a human being. You know, it means you're not some sort of mindless robot. It's when it gets to affect you on the road or in the emergency department that you need to sort of start thinking about professional help. When you're getting that sort of PTSD flashbacks, this case reminds me exactly of a case that I dealt with a year ago, 2 years ago, that didn't go well, and it impairs your ability to do a good job, then it's time to go and seek some professional help then. And the other thing is you're also there as an emotional support person for the parents or carers as well. And you don't really realize it at the time, but they're under such amazing sort of degree of stress. They're in that sort of fight or flight, pulse racing at 120, tunnel vision sort of state. And just by you physically walking into the room, their pulses will drop. They'll get a much better, you know, the sympathetic overdrive will slowly drop off. The parasympathetics will kick in and they'll be able to be a little bit calmer. You won't recognize it, but your emotional state will be contagious to them, just as we said earlier on. And so just your mere presence, even if you cannot do anything medically for the patient in front of you, will make a difference. And as I said, some of these cases will be the most important thing that's ever happened to these parents. And when you have horrendous outcomes, you will be absolutely remembered in how you act at that time. And just by being human and kind, then you can have an amazing impact both on how the parents deal with the situation there and then, but also their grieving process later on. And so one of the horrible things you get called to occasionally is, you know, stillbirths or sudden unexpected deaths. And you go in and you kind of know what you're going to see and you know you can't do anything. But just by being there, you are still doing something for that family.
Absolutely.
And it's hard on you being there at that sort of time, but you are still making a difference.
That makes a lot of sense. So going from now the emotional side that plays a big role in looking after pediatrics, now going to more, I guess, that clinical approach of, you know, going through the foundations of it, would you like to go through a bit about that?
So I think one of the best thing tools that can be used, whether that's in hospital or pre-hospital, is something called the pediatric assessment triangle. And it's been really well validated in the pre-hospital population over in the US. And really, it's a system of looking at a child, getting your clinical gestalt down and deciding, is this child essentially sick or not sick? And what organ system is involved? And really, it'd be lovely if I could just give you my years and years of practice, but I'll look at a child and generally I'll know if they're sick or not sick. And that's really hard when you're a student paramedic. You've no idea what is well and unwell. So the easiest thing to do then is to break it down into smaller components and have a look. So the pediatric assessment triangle is essentially made of three main parts. It's a triangle, obviously, so it's three parts. It's appearance, breathing, and circulation. So rather than airway, it's appearance, breathing, and circulation. And these are things you can do from the end of the bed, outside the car, without even having to talk to the parents or the child. And so when we're thinking about appearance, it's essentially, what does that child look like? Are they alert and interactive? Are they floppy? Are they doing anything else? And there's a mnemonic we can use called the Tickles mnemonic. And I can send you information to put in the show notes just as a reminder of that. So essentially we think about, what is the tone of that child? So if that child is sitting up, holding their neck and their head in the right place, that's great. I know then that they've got a reasonable GCS, things are working normally. But if that child is floppy in appearance, so hypotonic, perhaps they've just had a seizure, for instance, that's going to make me more concerned. Or if they're hypertonic, so they're extra stiff, again, that's going to make me more concerned what's going on. I want to know then if the child is irritable. And so what that really, and interactive. So generally speaking, most kids will at least look at you when you go in the room. And, you know, that will happen from the age of about 3 or 4 months. And unless they're teenagers, of course, and watching something on TV or playing on their Nintendo. But most children will interact with you if you ask them a question. And if you're getting in their face and in front of them and, you know, prodding and poking them, they should certainly interact with you in whatever age that is, whether that's just trying to grasp your finger or your pen light away, or just trying to pull your glasses off or pull your mask off your face, or try and strangle you, whatever they're going to do. Most children are interactive. If they're not interactive, then I'm going to be concerned there's something else going on. It is not normal to be ignored in these sort of situations. So that's my T, that's my I. I'm going to think then if they're crying or not. Now, kids, if you have kids, obviously, you know, they cry a lot. You know, it is normal for children to cry. It's especially normal for children to cry if they think people are watching them. And if you ever watch, you know, kids in the school playground, they'll fall over, look around to see if anyone's actually spotted they've fallen over, and then they'll burst into tears when they know there's someone who's seen them, but rather than just spontaneously burst into tears. But the big difference really is that most children who cry can be consoled, whether that's by their mom, by a dummy, by a cuddly toy, and sometimes by you. And that's a little bit about that sort of emotional contagion from the mother or the father to that child. You know, if children are in pain or distress, they will cry. But they can be calmed down most of the time. If there's something neurological going on, for instance, they've got a horrible thing going on in their head, they've, you know, had a, or then they might start crying and they're less likely to be consoled or looked after. And so we want to think about how they, if you can sort of manage what's going on there. We want to think about, the other things we need to think about really are, what else are they doing? Are they just looking like they're struggling? Are they interacting? Are they doing any abnormal movements? All those sort of things are going to make me think, okay, that's one arm of my assessment triangle. That takes 10 seconds to do, to look and see if anyone's normal or abnormal, if they're doing any funny abnormal movements. I'm then going to think about then what their breathing is like. And we can do, you know, can take that sort of look, listen, feel approach to their breathing. But essentially, children from the below the age of 6 are obligate nasal breathers, so they have to do their breathing from their nose. And so when they have a degree of respiratory distress, one of the first signs you'll see is they'll flare their nostrils like they're getting ready for a fight. you know, essentially try and get more oxygen into the system. Because one of the best ways they can regulate what's going on in the amount of oxygen that's getting in, they will start to breathe faster. And because they have less elastic chest walls than adults, when they breathe faster, the muscles between the ribs get sucked in. So we call that intercostal recession. They'll get subcostal recession. So the skin underneath the bottom of the ribs will get sucked in. And then they do this weird abdominal seesaw breathing where their tummy goes out and in, and their ribs go in the opposite direction. And then we'll see what we call a tracheal tug, where you'll see that skin just above the sort of the zipper stern, the sternum gets sucked in again, essentially as they try and create as much negative intrathoracic pressure as possible to suck air in, just to get past the obstruction. That's what we might see. We might also hear some funny noises that kids make. Now, most kids are snotty and snuffly, and a lot of them have big, large tonsils, and you'll hear that noise. And that's okay, because that's just snot up in the upper airways. If they're talking, great, I'm happy, just like in adults. If they're making normal baby noises, I'm happy. But you might hear some weird coughing noises. And one of the challenges of COVID is because there's less respiratory viruses around and everyone's washing their hands, you don't really see as much croup and bronchiolitis as you would do normally. But we might hear that sort of barking seal cough of croup, and you just know once you've heard enough of them what it is from the end of the road. You might hear that sort of wet, snuffly cough of bronchiolitis or that weird cough of whooping cough. And all those things are going to give you an idea that there's something going on in the respiratory system. And that's without even having to put a SATS probe on. You know, we know, you know, you could be counting a respiratory rate, and that's one of the first indicators that there's something wrong with this child as their respiratory rate goes up. So you're happy about their appearance, you're happy about their breathing, and then you think about what their circulation is like. And so really that's a little bit about what their skin color is, being mindful that darker skin tones, it's a lot harder to detect things like shock and cyanosis in. And so we use words like blue lips to describe someone who's, you know, potentially hypoxic or cyanotic. That doesn't work if you're Afro-Caribbean or you're African and you've got dark skin, for instance, you can't tell. We look, say if someone is pale, if they're anemic, but again, you can't tell if you're looking at someone's skin, so you're going to look at other places. And then we do things like looking at that sort of general level of hydration, so whether they've got moist mucous membranes, whether they're able to make tears, whether they've got wet lips, wet tongue, wet mouth. All those things are great. They would help me think that these child are well hydrated. And we think about things like the capillary refill, so, you know, pushing on their chest for 5 seconds and then releasing, counting to see, you know, how long it takes for that, those capillary beds to return to normal. And that's a great test, but only if it's ever really done by the same person. So if the three of us did a cap refill on the same child, we'd all have different answers. But if the three of us did it again, we'd have the same answer we did as the first time. So there's no point one of you doing the test on someone and then getting in the truck to drive whilst the other one's in the back with the kid, because you won't really be able to see how things are going. And then you've got to think about, okay, where am I going to test for my capillary refill? Because children, if they're cold and miserable, they'll, you know, their toes and fingers will get cold. So there's no point testing in sort of capillary nail beds of fingers. And so we'll often use the sternum to check. And obviously, if they've got darker skin, that's a lot harder to look at. So what I would do then is actually check in the bottom lip. So pull the bottom lip down and press on their gums, and you'll get a much better central capillary refill that you'll be able to see because the skin is nice and pink. And that'll give you a sense of what's going on. So just in sort of 30, 40 seconds, you've done your ABC assessment, your appearance, breathing, circulation assessment with this kid, and you've got a sense of where the organ system is that's going wrong. So it may be, okay, all three are fine. That's wonderful. Not really an issue. If it's only really an appearance problem, so maybe they're floppy, you know, they're not interacting normally, but there doesn't appear to be a breathing or a circulation problem, then generally the problem is most likely to be neurological in origin. If it's purely a respiratory problem or a breathing problem, then clearly that makes sense. It's going to be a, you know, it's just going to be a respiratory issue or a respiratory failure or respiratory distress. And if it's purely a you know, circulatory problem, then obviously, you know, again, we can think, okay, that's much more likely just be a circulation issue. It's when those arms of the triangle combine, it gives you a little bit more information and as to how sick the child is. So you get a sense of where the problem is in these kids. And then you think about, okay, how sick is this kid? So if the child has an appearance problem and that has caused a breathing problem, then I get concerned. Because essentially, for instance, imagine a child that's had a fit, they're postictal, they've lost a lot of muscle tone. So you know there's an appearance problem. And you can hear them breathing in an obstructive pattern. So they're going, okay, so we know there's a problem there. And these are sicker than a child that's just had a fit and is postictal and doesn't have an unsupported airway, for instance. And we know then, obviously, that kids respond to hypoxia by bradycardia. And so then if I think then there's a circulatory problem on top of that, then I know that I'm in this sort of vicious spiral where things are going to get a lot worse unless I intervene quickly. So that would be my basic quick assessment. And really from an observation point of view, you know, I've done that 60 seconds at most to have a look. And then I'm going to do some basic obs for a kid. And the most important ones you can do, if you could only do one test for most children, it would essentially be, I would suggest probably doing either a SATS, if that's all you can get, recognizing that it's a nightmare getting SATs on wiggly kids. But if they're wiggling, that's actually generally a good sign. You know, it's when they're not wiggling that I get more concerned, and a blood sugar. Because that's the one thing that you can do something about straight away. Those are the two things you could pretty much fix very, very quickly that could change absolutely everything. The last thing you want to see is a child that's potentially hypoxic, but you haven't recognized it, and you've got a 30-minute transit time to your hospital, or a kid with a glucose of 1.2 that you've not recognized, and they're flat as, and you've got a 30-minute drive to the hospital, and you could have fixed the problem there and then. You know, you'd fix that appearance, that breathing, that circulation problem. There are very few reasons that you need to do many other interventions in that sort of pre-hospital space. Certainly, obviously, there's those time-critical things like management of a cardiorespiratory arrest or anaphylaxis or sick asthmatics. But most things essentially could wait. And we'd much rather you took your time and made these children calm and their parents calm than doing an intervention which may actually make things worse, if that makes sense.
Definitely. And I really like how you've done, like, you know, that pediatric triangle all before really touching the patient. And that's all when you're walking in and finding out, like introducing yourself, you can get all those details basically without doing any extra interventions. And then it's really important, just like those basic obs where they come kind of second nature to the treatment of adults. However, with peds, you know, you kind of want to expedite that treatment process. So you work in an adult hospital as well as a pediatric hospital. So two different ones. Are your approaches to the same conditions? Is it two sides of the same coin, or are they completely different approaches?
So it depends. Let's take something like anaphylaxis, because that's something that could occur in either age group. I think one of the key differences, and I think the main difference is who you're talking to more than anything else. And so when I'm dealing with a child, I'm very much taking my time to do anything. I'm going to take my time to explain what's going on. Even though I know I've got to give this kid adrenaline intramuscularly, I'm going to take my time to explain this to the parents and the child if it's age appropriate, because it's going to make life a lot easier. I'm much less inclined to take so long with an adult, because you can shortcut your language. You can say, okay, I think you've got an anaphylactic reaction. I'm going to give you an injection into your thigh. This will make you better. Bang, it's done. You can't go up to a three-year-old child with a big, sharp, pointy needle and then just stab them, essentially, having explained things to their carers. So you've got to take a little bit more time in what you're doing. You know, in adults, we're quite happy putting, you know, giant 16-gauge cannulas in without even thinking about it sometimes. Not going to do that in a small child, or even a big child for that matter, without spending a lot of time coaching them. Because how we interact with them in those sort of early phases really impacts on the rest of their hospital stay. If you think someone, for instance, you've got a young diabetic child, for instance, if we treat them well and we try and treat them in a nice, calm manner, and we try and make all our interventions as pain-free and as stress-free as possible, we're probably going to make a huge impact on how they treat themselves in the future. We're going to think that, okay, they're not going to be afraid of going to a hospital. They're not going to be afraid of needles. But I remember a time when, for adult patients with COPD, for instance, it wasn't long ago when pretty much all of them had to have an arterial blood gas when they came into the hospital. You know, stabbing a needle into someone's radial artery is bloody painful. And I've seen many patients who've essentially tried to hold out as long as possible at home just so they wouldn't get this test done. But we would never do that in kids. We'd be putting local anesthetic in, we'd be talking to them, we'd be distracting, getting the clowns out, putting Bluey on the TV, all these sort of things. Maybe we should be doing that a little bit more in our adults. So there is that sort of difference in approach. And I think, obviously, a lot of the disease states are somewhat different. And most children have got a great physiological reserve compared to adults because they haven't got this massive past history and burden of disease behind them. And so you can be a little bit more cautious and slow in how you do things and do it right the first time rather than taking four attempts to put a cannula in and rogering every single vein going.
That's really good. So we're mindful of your time as you do a lot of extra work with some other countries as well. So I'd love to just finalize as well, just to get your main tips on communicating with a child.
So I think the first thing you want to be able to think is that generally you are this massive, scary giant in front of these kids. I'm 6'3", and a large number of my patients are about as big as one of my legs. And so you can imagine them straining their necks, trying to look up and deal with me. So the first thing I will do is get down onto their level, whatever that is, and try and be essentially at eye level with them. So if they're sitting on the floor playing, I will sit down on the floor and start interacting with them. And rather than going straight for the meat of the matter, what's wrong, I will actually try and interact with their environment a little bit first. So if these children are playing with their teddy bears or their toys, I will start asking them questions about those teddy bears and toys, because it's a lot less threatening than saying, where does it hurt? Where does it hurt? What's going on? What have you done? Let's have a look at this cut on your head sort of thing. And so that's how I would lead into the conversation. If they're old enough to talk, then it's really important to actually talk to the child first and say, hi, I'm Andrew. I'm the paramedic who's going to be looking after you. Do you mind if I ask mummy some questions? Do you mind if I ask daddy some questions? And it's giving that child a little bit of sense of control of the situation and what's going on. And then you turn and face the parent or carer and say, hi, I'm such and such. Do you mind if you tell me what's happened? You go through things there. But every now and then you're going to go back to the child and ask them to confirm things. Obviously, in older children, sometimes you have to get the parents out of the room. If they're teenagers, for instance, then we do see a lot more teenagers with mental health problems at the moment. And I'd be very mindful of what the conversations I'm going to be having in that sort of in the home space, in the pre-hospital space with these teenagers. But once I've established who I am and I'm on an eye level, and I try to be as non-threatening as possible. And so what I may do, for instance, is I carry my Sharpie in my pocket. I'm going to a kid. I'll draw a stupid moustache or cat's whiskers on my face mask, for instance, because it's a little less scary, essentially, than, if you were going wearing your Tyvek suits, anyone's going to, if they've ever seen E.T., they'd be frightened. They're going to be taken away and put in a freezer. But so it's the other thing to do then is alternatively what I'll do from a safe distance, I'll actually show them what I look like. I'll either show them a picture on my mobile phone. This is what I look like. And that's a great thing to do. Or if I can, I'll just show them my face if that's a safe thing to do. And then it's a little bit about distraction, a little bit about asking questions and taking your time to sort of establish a rapport and recognize that the words we use aren't understood by children most of the time. So children will say it hurts pretty much everywhere. So don't ask them where it hurts. There's no point. It's much better to ask them to show you where it hurts, because it hurts everywhere is pretty much the common response. But if they say it hurt, oh yeah, I've got a sorely poor tummy, and they say, where does it hurt? And they use one finger to point, somewhere to their belly button, for instance, then you're a little less concerned of what's going on. And so once you've got that sort of sense of what's, that's happening to them, make sure you explain everything that's going to happen so that you're not going to surprise them. Obviously, if you're going to do OBS on these kids, which hopefully you will, okay, I'm going to put this bandage around your arm, and it's going to blow up like a balloon, and it's going to get a little tight. may feel uncomfortable for a couple of seconds, but then it's going to come off and it's going to tell me how you're feeling. Or I'm going to put this little peg with some lights on your finger and it's going to show me how good your breathing is. You know, you want to use child appropriate words when you're explaining things to kids. And you don't then need to explain it to the parents as well, because hopefully they're listening as to what's going on. And so trying to keep that primary carer in the room with you at the same time or in the back of the truck is really important to help sort of establish that rapport and that connection with the kids. And depending on why you're there, then the next thing is, okay, you're there because, you know, the child's got difficulty in breathing. Okay, I've got some medicine that I can give you that's going to make you feel much, much better. And depending on what that is, let's say they've got croup. Okay, here's this delicious medicine I'm going to give you. If it depends if you've got Dex or Pred. Mix it with cordial. Always tastes nicer that way. I'm going to give you some medicine that's going to help your breathing and your cough. Or I can hear your chest sounds really wheezy and tight, and it sounds like it's really difficult to breathe. Do you mind if we give you some special medicine through an astronaut's mask that's going to help your breathing? Or, for instance, you've got that kid that you've gone to see in the school playground that's fallen off the monkey bars, and say, you, one of the things you can do is obviously ask the kid what they think is going on, or, you know, their arm looks obviously painful and deformed. Give them some painkillers. And it's horrible, the number of kids that come into hospital, not so much with broken arms, but other problems, that have had no analgesia whatsoever. There's a load of great studies looking at kids, for instance, with presumed appendicitis, who get nothing. And imagine if I went into hospital and I said, I think I've got appendicitis. And, you know, I've pretty much given 10 of endone before I've left triage. That does not happen in kids. They might get a paracetamol and think, really? You know, what's the difference? It's just, it's not really fair. So you want to get that appropriate sort of weight-based analgesia in as soon as possible. And, you know, intranasal fentanyl, wonderful thing for these kids. And again, it's coaching them, explaining what's going to happen. I'm going to give you some tickly spray up your nose. It may make you sneeze, but it's going to take all the pain away. And they can put this big cardboard box or this big plastic box around your arm so you don't have to see it anymore. And then, you know, pretty much every child in the world loves going in an ambulance. You know, so, okay, we're going to put you in the back of the ambulance. And yes, we're not going to put the sirens on because it's not safe, but explaining what they're going to see, what they're going to do, explaining a little bit about what they might see when they go into the hospital if they've never been before. All those things will help create a sort of connection that helps, a therapeutic connection in a way that's going to help make things so much easier. And just as we said right at the beginning of the podcast, it's that sense of calmness and that knowledge that you've got that helps you be calm really is contagious to those kids and the parents as well. And they really make it a lot easier then, you know, you've given them the pain relief, you've put their arm in a box splint, you're sitting with them and you're chatting with them because you're nice and calm, and then they're nice and calm because they know what's going to happen. They're not going to be fearful of going to the hospital.
That was really great insight. Thank you. You know, very mindful for your time. So thank you so much for coming on today and having a chat. Hope all of our listeners, you know, gain something out of this and hopefully makes them feel a bit less stressed and overwhelmed when going to a pediatric patient on placement. So where can our listeners find out a bit more about you?
So we run a website, it's called Don't Forget the Bubbles. So www.don'tforgetthebubbles.com. Or you can find us on Facebook, Twitter, Insta. No, not on TikTok, I'm sorry. or you can just hit me up and ask me questions on Twitter at Andrew J Tag. And I'm more than happy to answer any questions or provide any insights.
Thanks for listening to this episode of the Student Paramedic Podcast. You can get in touch with us through Instagram, Facebook, Twitter, or you can email us at thestudentparamedicpodcast@gmail.com.